Hello and welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, May 20th, 2021. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, and I am so thrilled with the number of responses we got to the survey, the Have You Read This survey of 13 books, and Rebecca has not seen the results. I'm not going to quiz her. I will say we were both wrong in interesting ways that we will talk about at length.
Okay, great.
I've got some pregame to do there. The other thing you can do, I love this poll. I should do this, should have done it for the movie drafts, and maybe we'll incorporate some more polling, because right now people have to email us, remember to do this, where if you have the link, you can go in. I think that made it super easy, but 590 responses to the which of these books have you read so far. I am now, as of this moment, closing the responses. So we're locked in here. We are still accepting responses for the summer movie. God, I keep saying summer movie. Summer book basket preview draft. You can see my picks, Rebecca's picks. We've got some voting in. I'll say nothing about them, so that doesn't it doesn't influence anything at all, ever, in any particular way. But we'll keep those open, I guess, for another week. By the time, well, maybe I'll close them by a week from today. So May 27th, I'll close the voting on that.
That
and then
reasonable.
We can talk, gloat, mourn, cajole, contest, deny, obfuscate, or otherwise problematize the results in whichever way we see
fit. If you want to join in on our next Book Nerd Movie Club, you still have like a week and a half-ish to read Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella and watch Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. That show will come out two Wednesdays from now. What is time?
I watched it over the weekend as I texted you. Probably the mood vibe pick, right? Which is the first 5 minutes of Costner looking over his shoulder in the cornfield.
During dusk. It's perfect.
It's really good stuff.
Yeah. I'm reading Shoeless Joe right now. It's my first time. And Bob has plans on one of the evenings this weekend. And I was like, perfect. I'm going to just have my Fortress of Solitude and watch Field of Dreams and do my whole vibe myself. We had a little conversation of like, do you want to watch Field of Dreams with me? Because I do this every year. This time I'm going to be, you know, like taking notes and stuff. And he was like, that feels kind of like a sacred solo joint. And I was like, all right, okay.
The Eleusinian Mysteries, you know, kind of a situation. Are you getting Brood X there, by the way? Speaking of summertime, cricket noise, is it?
We are supposed to, yeah. I have not seen any of them in my neighborhood yet, but I'm starting to hear stuff about other folks in and around Richmond and in Virginia getting the cicadas. Yeah.
It was we did the whole thing. Like, I don't do it very often where I actually like use the surround sound system, but this you got a score and it's very cicada forward, the soundtrack to Field of Dreams. And I was like, are there crickets in my house? Are there locusts and stuff in my house?
Surely someone at like Outside Magazine is doing like the top 10 crickety cicada filled movie score.
This has got to be up there because there's a lot of Dusk and Dawn, you know, Dusk and Dawn, the magic hour, famously for Field of Dreams. And that's if you're from the Midwest at all or other places that have locusts, cicadas, frogs, all the noisemakers of summer show title come out when the sun is coming up and going down. And a lot of this movie takes place in that golden hour. But I've got a lot of notes. Got a lot of thoughts. Got a lot of notes. As of yesterday, you could get Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella for 99¢ on Kindle. It was on sale, so you could go pick that up.
Oh, nice.
If you want to go read along there. It's not very long. I think it started out as a novella. Actually, it's just not very long. As you can tell from the movie, it's almost a short story. Like, you could do it. There's a version of it you could do in a short story.
And I think it started as a short story. Just before this call, I was down a fun Field of Dreams internet rabbit hole about the origins of the story and like the original book reviews from 1982 of the book and all sorts of things. And I think it did start as a short story that then grew into the full novel.
All right. So let's do a sponsor break and then we'll make some progress towards something, but I don't know that we'll make very much. We'll see.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
Another point of order in terms of episodes that are coming up. I don't know when this is scheduled for. Is this Q2 for the It book discussion? We were just noodling about this today.
Oh, yeah.
Do we want to decide? Have we decided?
I think we have decided.
Tell people what we've decided.
We are going to read Crying in H Mart. Mm-hmm. I don't have the author's name in front of me. But the Book Riot Insiders get an option every quarter to help us decide or let us know what kind of episode, what kind of content we're going to do for one of our episodes. And they selected an It book discussion. So we have picked for our It book, Crying in H Mart. And yeah, we'll just discuss that sometime in June. So we'll keep you posted.
It came out April 20th. It's a memoir by Michelle Zahner. I think that's how you say that name.
Yes.
H Mart, if you don't know it, is a chain of really awesome Korean grocery stores. There's one three blocks from my house. It just opened last year. And it's a memoir of food, of family, of immigration. Zauner, I think she's the front woman for the band Japanese Breakfast. She's from Portland. Mm. But we like a food memoir. Throw in a little
Indeed
crying. Crying is in the title, Rebecca. What are we doing here? I'm just now realizing.
We're going to watch Field of Dreams, and then we're going to read a memoir with crying in the title. Gilead this year, too.
Or last year. If you want to get on board.
We're okay. We're going to be okay.
I'm going to find an audio, because as you know, audio is my preferred format for memoir. This sounds like, could we have an Hope Jaron experience of actual, what they call it, interstitial. No, what do they call it, where it's like, you're watching a movie and then you're hearing the soundtrack that's also the characters are hearing too. There's like some phrase for that. I can't remember what it is.
Oh.
Anyway, doesn't matter. But we could get some real authentic inline emotion here, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah. A lot of plaudits. I'm not plucking something out of obscurity here. Best book of instant New York Times bestseller. Amazon named it one of their best books of April. Got mentions all over the place. I think this is might be an interesting bookend to David Chang in some ways.
I was thinking that also. Yeah. And as much as I love to talk about a novel, and we're coming off of doing Clara and the Sun as our most recent one, I feel like we are in a particularly good mode with a memoir.
I think so too.
That feels like a good thing to take apart.
I think so too. And it's talking about food. All right. So here we go. All right. A little front matter before we talk about the survey results. People really like to do this. I think one thing we've learned running this site for almost 10 years now is that people like to tell you what book they've read. They just like to do it. Call it narcissism, call it sharing, call it community. Depending on my mood, I'll use any and all of those terms. So I'm not surprised we have a lot of response. I'm surprised by 600. A couple of notes from readers who then wrote in. And reasonably so, from our international crew. This is a very, almost exclusively an American list and exclusively an English list, which is fair. The only non-American title here is Pride and Prejudice. Everything else is kind of in the, very much in the American high school to college curriculum plus recent-ish mainstream reading experiences.
Yes, right? And very reflective, for good or ill, I think likely for ill, of how U.S.-centric most high school and college reading lists
And not for nothing, remain. We're Americans. Most of our audience is Americans. But I think it's a different list, of course, if it's you're listening to an Australian podcast and you're Australian, or you know, you're listening to Malaysia or something else like that. You know, a world literature survey would be an interesting one, where you're taking some classics from world literature and making a similar. I've got ideas for polls here. Now that I've seen that there's fish that will bite this hook, I think we got some future content segments going on here. But other than that, I will say I misled you with the early results. I did tell you one early result. And do you want to tell the people what I told you?
You told me that To Kill a Mockingbird was in the lead.
And it did not end up in the lead.
Oh, okay.
It was close. Well, To Kill a Mockingbird, 87% of respondents said they have read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Whoa.
Which now that has to reset your expectations of what we're talking about, I think.
Wow, okay.
Because you said 68% was your guess. And that I thought that was high. I think I came in below that. So now, again, if you haven't read a bunch of these, there's some selection bias in, you know, in how we do surveys, right? So if you haven't read a bunch, I would guess most people who's like, I've read two of these, they probably didn't play along. So people who've read a lot probably were more likely to respond. But even within that, there's really like kind of three tiers here. So To Kill a Mockingbird's on the top tier, but it is not the number one here. Do you want to guess what eclipsed it by a mere 8 votes? So To Kill a Mockingbird had 514, say people said they read it, that's 87%. The number one spot was 522, so it was close at 88.5%. Where would you place your second best guess here?
I think I put my bets on Pride and Prejudice being most popular.
Oh, okay, you were wrong for that. So then. It was not Pride and Prejudice.
Okay, well, if it's not Pride and Prejudice,
let me stop there. Pride and Prejudice is number 3, though it was number 3, but it dropped all the way down to 71.1%. That's why I'm saying there's tier. These top two were, you look at the bar graph, and that's like the Empire State Building of, you know, the New York skyline. Like, there's other things there, but it's the prominent one.
All right, so then I'm going with
the Great Gatsby. 522, 88.5% of the vote.
Wow.
I find this to be a pretty striking result that more people have read Great Gatsby than To Kill a Mockingbird. I find that pretty surprising, I have to say.
So you said it's 8 votes?
It's only
difference?
8, so it's, you know, it's 1.5, but still, I really thought To Kill a Mockingbird was far and away. I thought it would be much more well-read, and I would have guessed, like you, that Pride and Prejudice would have fallen to number 2. So we're underestimating Gatsby. Now, is there anything interesting there of our underestimation of Gatsby, Rebecca? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's anything interesting there.
No, I think these tiers are meaningful. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have guessed Pride and Prejudice, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Gatsby would be the top 3. I'm not convinced that 8 votes out of 600 is like a persistent difference.
No, and if we had 50 more people, and maybe these are even the more casual respondents, does the most engaged respondents actually tell you something represent? But these are just the people who've responded, so we got what we got.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I'm thinking about how, you know, academics write up research like this, and it would be like 600 listeners to a very wonky book podcast have read these books, and here are the ways in which how those people might be different from, you know, typical readers. I wish that we had also asked, did you read this in school or on your own?
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's here. So that's tier 1, Gatsby and Mockingbird, 88-ish, 87%. Tier 2, as I already said, Pride and Prejudice, 71%, 423 votes. Number 4 was 417 votes, so another 6 vote difference here. So take that, which was 70.7%. Any guesses what the fourth
Huck Finn.
1984. George Orwell's 1984. Huck Finn is weird. It kind of a stair step down. It's at 60%. It is the next most read, but it's the only one in the 60%.
Okay.
It's not decile, I guess is how you would say that. There's a huge grouping around half. Around half of respondents saying they've read these things. Now we're... Do you want to come up from the bottom then, maybe? Maybe the bottom then is more interesting because we've got a, the bell curve situation is fairly reasonable here. I'm not sure what to make of this, but the least read one, only 131 people have read this one, 22.2%. Any guesses what that would have been?
The Vanishing Half, just because it's the
that
newest.
Is incorrect. The Vanishing Half was 247. 41.9% of people said they read Vanishing Half, which is only four from the bottom. Actually, it's not even the bottom. The bottom is Gilead by Marilynne Robinson.
Oh!
Like, what have we been doing here this whole time?
We told the people to lie to us, Jeff.
Maybe this is them lying
to us.
They did
not lie to us. Oh, don't tell me that.
In all fairness, to people's bad taste.
I was going to say, now we're going to do a generous reading.
It wasn't a bestseller. It's not recent.
It's not on school lists.
And it's not recent. It's not on school lists. And it's not a classic. So my hindsight is 2020 can come up with a story there that it is literary. It's the most literary fiction that's not on syllabi, right? Of this
list. What was the percentage
again? 22.2%.
Okay.
So I'd like you all to know that what you've done is a 48-part close read of Gilead, starting now. Rebecca, let's go.
Goodbye to your dreams of Lonesome Dove.
I wish I would have included Lonesome Dove. That was another regret that I should have put Lonesome Dove on. Would it have been above or below Gilead? It has to be below. I have to believe
this is now a Gilead podcast. You know, though, I don't want to let go of the point that you made at the top of this segment that overall the results to this are much higher than we would have anticipated. And I think last week, if you had told me this survey is going to show that 22% of your listeners, or at least of the ones who respond, have read Gilead, I probably would have been delighted, because that in that framing of how I was thinking about things last week, where I thought Pride and Prejudice and To Kill a Mockingbird were going to be the most popular and that like two-thirds of people would have read those. Right. For Gilead to come in at like one-third as popular as those two things would have delighted me. But now I'm just disappointed.
It's not that I'm angry.
I'm just disappointed.
Also, I think we might need to kiss whatever dreams of being quote unquote influencers goodbye, because what else can we do here? Do I have to lip sync the words to like K-pop with Gilead in my hands on TikTok to get people to read this?
This is the result of our influencing.
This is it. If it was zero,
I mean,
otherwise.
That also
can't prove a negative. Right,
that also means we should probably kiss our influencer dreams goodbye. But
anyway. Also, that was the only thing in the 20%. And then, so let's jump up to the 30% cadre. There's three in the 35 to 41% range. Again, another one I was dead wrong on. Their Eyes Were Watching God, 35.3%.
Oh, okay.
Hasn't penetrated. Do people go back and read this if they didn't read it in high school and college was my question.
I
think maybe
don't
they,
think
clearly
so.
They don't. Here's another tough beat for us, literature writ large.
Ooh,
beloved. 38.3%. All kidding aside about Gilead.
But 40% of readers having read Beloved, that's
But this
that
is a reader's, Rebecca. These are people who listen
know,
to us talk about this garbage every week. This should, this, people, read Beloved. Please do it for me.
Please do.
Please, forget about, no, don't forget about, but Gilead, look, that's more. Again, it's a mainstream book. We're not plucking something out of like University of Nebraska Press from 1968 with Gilead. I won a Pulitzer Prize. Oprah picked the stupid thing. Like, but Beloved, this is difficult reading.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what to tell you. Go read Beloved.
If we can't convince people who are listening to this kind of bookish podcast that they can handle Beloved and should handle Beloved, then I think
more people have read The Underground Railroad. This is a shocking result to me. 265, 44.9% of people have read The Underground Railroad and haven't read Beloved. I like Underground Railroad. I think it's a great work. Mm-hmm. You've heard me say, we have agreed that The Underground Railroad is probably the signal work by America's greatest living novelist, Colson Whitehead. I'm totally happy with that. That said, it is two notches down Beloved as a literary work, especially when you look at a timeline.
I don't think Colson Whitehead wants more people to have read The Underground Railroad than to have read Beloved. At this point, maybe on the long tail, we'll see.
If I include, is it Song of Solomon more? Is it Paradise more because they're not as tough?
Here's my pitch. If you read The Underground Railroad, you can hang with the content of Beloved.
I don't care if you can. Go read it. Rebecca is trying to get you something to hold on to. It's tough. It is tough, but come on. I'm not happy about this. You can do better. We can do better. We can do better here together.
If anyone would like to recommend ways we can be better influencers.
Probably not try to get people to read fiction from 35 years ago.
Fiction that's known to be difficult and emotionally draining. Very challenging.
Very difficult.
Speaking of, I texted you about it. I have started the Underground Railroad TV series. And then I watched the first episode. It is wrenching. I mean, it should be wrenching.
The book
this
is
content
wrenching.
Should be wrenching. Yes. The book is wrenching. There's something about seeing it on screen with real humans that is just multiplicative in how powerful it is. And I finished the first episode and I thought, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. And then I went and read several reviews where the reviewer said the same thing. Like, I had to take a break after the first one. Barry Jenkins is on the record of saying he doesn't think they should have released all 10 episodes at once because it's not content that you should marathon. So I'm in it. I'm just going to I have decided to follow the advice and give each episode breathing room and process a lot. And it's 100% in the land of content. I don't think you can reasonably encourage anyone else to watch or recommend that anyone else watch. It's really challenging. And there are 9 million reasons that a person might not want to put that in their eyeballs. But if you have been considering it and you haven't gone down the rabbit hole of pieces about it like I have, I guess I would say if you're on the fence and you're leaning towards giving it a shot, the first one is very difficult. By many accounts, it might be the most difficult.
That makes sense to me, knowing the cadence of the book. Like, you know, the book starts off with the first time he asked, Cora said no, or something like that, right? Where they're really trying to, again, there's a little bit of a spoiler here, just in terms of this is about escaping to the north. And you spend some time down south realizing what they're escaping, right?
Right.
Like why they're taking this huge risk and this wild journey.
And that's exactly the scene that they're setting in this first episode of what daily life is like on this plantation in Georgia. It is unflinching. Everyone on this cast and crew and all of the writers should win all of the
awards. I've heard it's nothing short of a signal production of... and beautiful and moving and well cast and directed and from a filmmaking point of view. And let's not call this TV. I think we're in the realm of whatever we call filmmaking is what we're doing.
It's going to feel like watching 10 short films. Yeah. I'm sure of it having watched the first one, and it's very absorbing. And then in moments I would find myself popping out of the story just enough to think, oh my God, how did they do this? Like, how did they get through it? And I remember we talked about some of those moments that looked like they would have been really difficult in Watchmen. And this is just even next level from that. So
if I hadn't read the book, I'd be more inclined to experience it because it'd be a way of experience the story in this particular kind of artistic work. I can see why they didn't just release the first one, knowing that was sort of the descent, right? Like you want to give someone, if they're going to go to the next one, you don't want to leave them a week. Are they going to turn on episode 2 after being like, oh my God, at least you can kind of move through the story towards, you know, up from slavery, to quote, you know, the Booker T. Washington is kind of the shape of the rest of it. But you need the Golgotha of what they actually are, you know, why they would put themselves on the line in a terrible way.
Yeah, and it's there's, you know, all the trigger warnings for everything that you would assume for watching it. And if you have difficulty watching kids be harmed, that is on screen very early. So here's a warning for that.
Okay, snapping back. So, Beloved, anyway. 38.3%. It's not okay, internet people.
It's not okay.
That more of you have read Little Fire. Little Fires Everywhere, right in the middle. Little Fires Are Educated, actually, 304, 51.15%. Mm-hmm. I guess on some level it makes sense to me that those are more read than Beloved. I guess it does in some way make sense. Those are commercial fiction, not as demanding.
Book clubby.
Book club, more recent. Again, Beloved is such tough sledding, like Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is not tough sledding, to be perfectly frank. These are books you pick up for quote-unquote fun, I guess. They're, you know, people aren't like, what am I going to read next? And like, yeah, now's the time for Beloved. Like, whereas with Little Fire Everywhere and Educated, it had their moments of late. And Beloved is never going to be a book club book. It could be, but it's just when we talk, I'm guessing I'm talking capital B, capital C book club in that estimation. Vanishing Half, 42%. Educated and Little Fires Everywhere, as I said, 51%. Huck Finn, 60. Pride and Prejudice, 71. Underground Railroad, 44%. And then Becoming, 45.6%. So, the respondents just have read way more of the books than I thought.
Yeah.
But relative speaking, it's the things on the bottom, the top and the bottom, I was most surprised to see just the penetration. I'm not surprised that Mockingbird, Gatsby, Pride and Prejudice, and 84 were the most read. Those are things people enjoy. They're not, I'll put it this way, those are not hard reads. They're classics, but those are not difficult reads. And that matters. That really matters. Mm-hmm. And Beloved is a more important work than any book on here, but it's about 10 times more challenging.
Yeah. I second all of those emotions. I think it's maybe important too that, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is such an enduring cultural thing and has a movie that people like. And then there, of course, there was all the hubbub in the last couple of years where more folks went and read To Kill a Mockingbird because of Gossetta Watchmen. Gatsby's got an adaptation. It's like just a piece of culture you have to know. And Pride and Prejudice has that whole adaptation.
Austin industrial complex.
Penumbra. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, any thoughts for us?
Please go read Beloved.
Please read Beloved at some point. And that's joking about Gilead. Maybe Beloved's one where, okay, give someone something to hang on to. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here, but I'd be curious. Like, I'd let podcast at bookriot.com, other kinds of polls like this you might be interested. Like, there's a world literature poll that I could imagine picking, you know, Garcia Marquez or, Arrow of God, or, you know, what are the great world literature things out there? I guess another one would be interesting to do a which 2021 releases have you read, right? Mm. When we get to the half, or maybe at the end of the year, like, okay, here,
maybe at the end of the year, like that sounds good.
We do books that maybe people haven't read, but what if we did the inverse of this, which is for the books that you haven't read the most, do you think you ever will? Do you plan on ever reading it? Because I would guess Beloved would score differently in that regard. Maybe it's number one, but it's just so hard to get there. But I found the results both not surprising and surprising simultaneously.
Yeah, and probably the way we talk about Beloved doesn't help us. Like, and I mean you and me and the culture, the way that we all talk about Beloved.
That's a fair point.
It's true. It doesn't help us sell it. Because even from that perspective, Underground Railroad is difficult subject matter, but narratively, the prose is much more accessible.
Right. So there's the real story. Thank you. But in all kidding aside, thank you, everyone, for participating. We had a good time.
Fascinating.
We're going to be thinking of other interactive things we can do. But until then, we're going to take a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Tor Books. So if you are a fan of epic fantasy, if you're a fan of Scott Lynch and or Joe Abercrombie, but you want something a little different, you want a hero who's like a bit of a mess, then The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan is for you. In it, Academy dropout slash disgraced noble heir Lacan Gordova's life is in shambles. All he's got going for him is, one, he is a card sharp of considerable skill, and two, a lot of, maybe potentially a little too much, wine. So those are the positives. So when the bizarre murder of his father robs him of even the off chance of redemption, Lacan decides to make amends another way. He's going to unravel the mystery behind the killing, even if it takes him to the underbelly of Sophrona, a city of danger, secrets, and merchant princes. Finding the truth is one thing. Finding the truth and staying alive is like a whole other thing. So make sure to check out The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan on sale May 7th. And thanks again to Tor Books for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, this I'll start with my funny kind of thing that I found. I was talking about I went on my e-reader. I got all my e-reader stands rallied. We're all ready to go. And my one critique was, I wish the damn thing was bigger, the Kindle Oasis. And somewhere over in at Kobo, someone heard the clarion call and have released a 10.3-inch Kobo Ellipsa. And the headline on The Verge is, brings back super-sized e-readers. And I had forgotten that the Kindle DX used to exist. Do you remember the Kindle DX at all? Were you ever into the Kindle DX life?
No, I was not. I mean, I'm a tiny-handed person, yes. So I'm not owning the giant e-reader.
The Kindle DX was a larger, I think it was 9-inch sort of thing. And so this is
9.7.
Yeah, 9.7. This 10.3 is the largest e-ink mass market display I've seen. And I would love, if this was an, listen, I know. I hear you. I'm part of me is with you, but not enough. If this was an Amazon device, I'd be sending in my Oasis and getting credit or whatever I have to do to get some of this back. Cause this is the format. This is the format I want. It's like a hardback kind of a size, but with all the advantages of e-ink. It also comes with a stylus. You can annotate stuff. Also Kobo, since Kobo and Overdrive are owned by the same company, which is Rakuten. I mean, welcome to Japanese corporate structure 101. It has really good Overdrive / Libby / library integration for ebooks and audiobooks. But now that I've tasted the forbidden fruit of Edelweiss galley integration on my Kindle Oasis, I cannot go back to bread and salt, man. I'm eating mangoes off the tree of free galleys. I cannot go this as much as I would like to.
I'm just going to be a little bit bitter that I had to tell you for like 5 years how convenient it
Look,
is.
Look, I finally read Beloved. What do you want me to say? What do you want me to... Here's the thing, but I wasn't reading Front List. I wasn't reading Front List.
I know. You were on Operation No TV.
I was on my Operation Try to Learn How to Run a Company So We Don't Go Belly Up. That's what operation I was on. And still, that's there. But I have a little more time for Front List as well. So go check that out. If any of you buy one of these, please tell me. Do I want people to tell me? It's $399. Comes with a stylus.
I mean, we're not going to just find out on our own. Yeah. So
right.
Please do tell us. In the land of galleys you could download, I saw yesterday that Peter Heller has a new novel coming out in August.
Wow.
another heart-racing thriller about a young man who is hired by an elite fishing lodge in Colorado. I'm just reading the synopsis.
What does elite fishing lodge even mean? I love it. I'm in. It's awesome.
Amid the natural beauty of sun-drenched streams and forest, he uncovers a plot of shocking menace. Nature and menace? Like, what more do you want?
Fly fishing, but you might die. Peter Heller.
The river was so good. Right. The river so was just good. What? Canoeing, but you might die. Yeah.
I like this, how it's kind of gone the opposite way of Andy Weir, which space, but thriller. Let's just do rivers and streams, but thrillers. What kinds of things can happen to you while wearing L.L. Bean is the Peter Heller niche we're looking at now.
So many. This and is apparently dangerous. Exactly
yeah.
The niche I want to
I really like it, too. It's cozy and yet fraught. At the same time,
all these layers of quilted
it's
down.
It's really good stuff.
You know, Bob and I started listening to the new Andy Weir on a road trip last week, and I think my pitch for it is like it's a combination of The Bourne Identity in space and a cousin of Arrival.
I read it. I didn't tell you. Did I tell you? I read it.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah. Okay. I'm saving that for later, but yeah.
Okay.
The things we said about it
we're
before.
We're not done with
we're
it
We're not
yet.
Done. We'll hang on to this. We're in doing sorts. Giant e-reader. That's in the agenda. It's just giant e-reader in like all bold caps.
I know. And I hadn't clicked it, but I was like, wait, okay, there it is. It is indeed a giant e-reader.
That's what it is. It's on the tin. I mean, I think it's smart. I'm a little surprised there's not more variation in the Amazon Kindle line as they're the 900-pound gorilla. Like we've seen, I guess the equivalent would be over time, the segmentation we've seen in iPhones, right? The iPhone is the signal. It's not the largest by market share, but it's like kind of the Xerox of smartphones, right? It's the standard. But you can go from the iPhone Plus Max thing all the way down to a mini, and there's like six or seven pieces in there. Right now from Amazon, you can get the Kindle and the Paperwhite, which are functionally the same size. I guess the Paperwhite is a little bit better of a screen and maybe a backlight. And then you go to the Oasis and that's it. So there's room for, this is room for like a power e-reader. And if you're going to buy Kobo, you're probably a power e-reader anyway, because you're kind of actively deciding against Amazon at that stage if you're getting a Kobo device. So why not give the people like, you know, the Maybach of e-readers? Like these are people who are into e-reading. They've made a decision about their lives. They're getting off the Amazon life. Reward them with like this funky lowrider of a machine, right? That only like real super fans are going to care about. But I think it's great. I would love to see more choices there, especially. So anyway, where do we want to go next? There's a lot of other interesting stories this week. I'm not really. Yeah, do we stay on Amazon for just a minute or on the text?
Sure. Yeah. So
tell
let's
me about
do that.
That one.
All right. Well, so this week, a thing that we've been watching and I think hoping for a long time has happened. The Digital Public Library of America is they have signed an agreement with Amazon Publishing that will make all of Amazon's about 10,000 Amazon Publishing ebooks and audiobooks, which have been exclusive to Amazon and not available to libraries. Now they will be available to libraries and their patrons. And the DPLA is the only nonprofit library centered content marketplace. So this is a huge win. There's some more details about like how the licensing is. There's four different licensing models that Amazon is doing with the DPLA, and we might be the only two people in the world who care about any of those details. But the broader piece that Amazon produces exclusive content and that folks who don't access Amazon or can't access Amazon for whatever reason have not been able to access that content using their libraries has been a real issue for a long time, and something that we've wanted to see addressed. So it's very cool to see that. And over time, especially as Amazon grows their publishing and does exclusive audiobook deals, even with authors whose books come out from some of the big five publishers, that content being accessible to folks who aren't buying in the Amazon ecosystem but are accessing their libraries is important just for baseline access and equity reasons. So I'm really happy to see it happen. I would have loved to be like a fly on the wall in probably some very boring conversations about this, but I would love to know how they got this done and what got Amazon to say yes. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I'm surprised it's taken this long. I feel like this is one of those situations where Well, I don't know. Maybe it's maybe more of the levee breaking than I would think. I'm glad to see it. There's a lot more work still to be done here, but this is good news. I think there's no way to say, okay, could it have been more? What about Audible? You know, there's a whole bunch of other ways we could go with this, but I think this is good news. I think this is good for libraries. It brings, it enters Amazon's publishing into sort of the main of how we think about publishing in libraries. This is what we said before, right? That this is, mm-hmm. you know, this is something we kind of, is table stakes for, we expect publishers who do book-related work to doing. I don't know if you want to call it a tax or whatever, but like that you have some involvement in the library ecosystem. So I think that's good. I'm anxious for more down the road.
I also think I would have believed it if this had never happened. You know, like I was willing to believe that Amazon would never have agreed to it. It wouldn't be surprising with how Amazon rolls. So from that side, there's much more, that I think we would like to see done. And this is not something that I assumed we would ever see.
No, I guess I didn't assume it. I think the other way you can look at this, too, is now that Congress is interested in big tech in a way they haven't been for a while. And it's not just because people are getting banned off Twitter for being racist or, inciting violence, hashtag 2020. It's that there is more scrutiny on both sides of the aisle about the power of big tech and big tech companies. Amazon is one of the largest companies in the world. They're the most important company in the world of books and reading. Not the most important publisher, but they're the most important company. If you are strategic about kind of laying the groundwork for future antitrust litigation, you cannot walk into Congress and say, we haven't made our books available in libraries ever. You can't do it.
That's true.
So there's a strategic piece to it that maybe some bare minimum ticks a box that they can walk in. Because if they're, 80% of the dollars spent on books in America are flowing through Amazon, plus they can't go to the libraries, which we consider a public good. Like I've done, and we talked about some, nothing has a higher Q rating than libraries. You cannot be the 900-pound gorilla and not share and not let people draw water from the well when it comes to libraries. I don't think that would be a tenable position. So the cynical / realist part of me is this is to not be able to walk into, Elizabeth Warren saying, and why exactly haven't you made stuff available? Like no one's going to come out looking good there.
I mean, I think if you're taking the cynical reading with Amazon, you're not
strategic, cynical, could be. Well, I'm serious. Like, what cynical is person strategic is another person cynical in that particular way. Mm-hmm. The net effect is improvement for library access.
I don't assume it's from the goodness of their hearts.
No. Why? I mean, we've seen all publishers think about, do we really want to do this with libraries? We saw Macmillan. They're thinking about, is there some way we can have a middle or corner? Mm-hmm. Can we still get the kudos and the everyone loves books? Follow us on Instagram. Books are grand. Neil Gaiman quote here. And also not give it to libraries. The answer is no. I think the answer is no. I think that's just not going to fly. And Amazon was the one that, because they built out their publishing arm online first, there was a bit of a, Rebecca broke my heart by telling me frog boiling is not actually a natural effect. I still believe that there's like an endowment effect kind of thing that happens to us where we just get used to something, right? So I'm going to use frog boiling. I don't at me, whatever. We can go ask Adam Grant about whatever. It was Adam Grant that made this terrible revelation that I wish
it
I could
was. Write. It's in Think Again,
which I will read at some point. But having said all that, Amazon and started slow, and a lot of their stuff was digital first, and ebook lending in libraries wasn't awesome at the beginning, gave them sort of cover to people just get used to Amazon stuff not being there. The other thing I think is true too is Amazon ain't got the hits. Right? I mean, that's also given them some degree of cover and I don't know if there's like a chicken and the egg thing there. Like if they had more available in bookstores and libraries, would they have had more hits? Because like, what's the most famous Amazon book now? Like this Marcus Seiki kind of stuff? I don't even know.
Oh, yeah. Which is years ago. Like,
I mean, I know they sell books and they get Kindle Unlimited or whatever, but in terms of mind share, I can't name an Amazon book that I've read.
Mm-mm.
You know, remember the Penny Marshall memoir was supposed to be a big deal? Pfft. Nothing.
Oh, right. You know what? An Amazon book that we've both read was The Good Job Strategy. Wasn't that,
was that
published
Amazon
by Amazon?
I think so. I thought that was Harvard Business Review. We can look it up. But that we're fishing like this is the story, right?
Right.
We can maybe pick out one. So I don't know. Like if you're publishing, Did you, if you're publishers, do you want Amazon in the libraries competing with your stuff on the shelf? I wonder about that. No one asked publishing if they want Amazon in libraries. Not that we care.
Yeah. It's the Good Job strategy was New Harvest. That's it's Amazon. Amazon.
Okay, there you go. Which is a really interesting book. Highly recommend Good Job Strategy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have much else there. So I guess if I had to bet $100 on Amazon ever or not having their stuff available, I mean, Infinity's a long timeline. Let's say in the next 10 years, is that a fair enough? I think I probably would have put my money on Amazon having to do something with libraries. Just looking at the ways public pressure, political pressure, legal pressure, those things together probably add up to a 51% chance of it happening, if I think about it that way.
I think I would have gone that direction, but I think it wouldn't have been like, 90-10,
I'm sure that they're going to go.
I still would have really believed that it might not have ever happened.
Yeah, I would have taken, given the right odds, I would have placed a bet on it never happening in that 10, or not happening in a 10-year window. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree.
Sure, or given a different administration, a different political climate.
Speaking of political climates, Constance Grady coming through with a really good piece in Vox that the top half is more of a timeline of Pence backward a little bit. And then there's the back half of the story was new stuff to me. Was it new to you about Christine Ball and Linda Fairstein and all this stuff that happened in Dutton? Or had you heard any of that? I don't think we covered it on the show.
I remember when it happened with Linda Fairstein and Dutton and pulling Fairstein's book because of new coverage around the Central Park Five. But it didn't get a lot of attention. Yeah. I mean, it was also happening in the middle of 2019 when the political climate was bonkers and a ton of other things were happening, but we weren't really having this, like, quote unquote, cancel culture conversation. And I say that with a lot of scare quotes around it in publishing. But most of the details were new to me there. I think the pieces, like, I mean, it's Constance Grady for Vox, like the work is going to be good. But if you've been wanting big picture context and the sort of backstory of how we arrived at this moment in publishing, you're not going to do better than this, I don't think.
And it's not really an opinion piece. It's really more saying, like, these are the tensions, is young versus old. Younger people saying, why don't they see this? Interestingly, not just that we have a moral objection, but a publicity problem. Like, let us help. Let us help you help us not, you know, roll around in feces when this stuff comes out. And some stuff about, you know, trying to hire more people and not getting any more BIPOC authors, LGBTQ, and some other stuff. Read the piece. I don't know. I'm not sure there's much else we can say about it, but it is a good overview of several pieces we've known, some other context. And there is, like I've suggested, at least I won't speak Rebecca here, intuition codified by also talking and knowing people in publishing that their rank and file, middle management down to junior, has a different, much like we talked about. In fact, can I do a little birdie thing for a minute?
Yeah, please.
I love a birdie. I was talking to a little birdie who works in publishing, and someone they work with listens to this show. So if you're out there, you don't know who I'm talking about, you, but anyway. And reaffirmed that the way we talk about this stuff is more like what the rank and file people in most publishing houses talk about, which is not a surprise. I guess I'd be surprised if they were radically more radical. I mean, we're leftists. We're not progressives. Like, you know, that's, I'm speaking again for you here in that regard.
Yeah.
But I'd also be surprised if they were much more to the right than us, frankly, knowing these are educated people in New York City working in the arts media. Like, historically, that's been a left-wing. So it's not surprising. The difference is that the business-level decisions in terms of titles, the conversation has moved around sort of a general ACLU definition of publishing and distribution of messaging to a, if reading and publishing is political, then the kind of things you publish has political weight. And it seems like it should be obvious, but it hasn't been obvious for a long time that that's how people are thinking about it. So it's happening. It's going to continue to happen. I think, to go back to our Amazon story before, my average expected return is that we will indeed see fewer books by conservative of a kind conservative people coming out from big five publishers. I would also expect there then to be, if I'm Fox News, I don't want to do this, but if I'm one of those, I open up my own publishing house. I just do. I take my Bill O'Reilly's and I take my Josh Hawley's and I give a middle finger to the pinko communists like us saying this is bad and there's a business there and people are going to buy it because we saw who gets elected. I don't want that to be the happen. But if you're Simon & Schuster and PRH, are you going to try to compete with them on that stuff? Or does that give you some liberty to just sort of let it go? I don't know. Maybe it makes it easier to say there's, you know, those people, that's what they do. That's not what we do. But anyway, Constance Grady, nice piece. Vox.
Yeah.
She's a good follow. I don't do Twitter very often, but sometimes I go and she's one of the people I look for. And I subscribe to Vox through my RSS reader and I always read her bylines. And she was on with us for annotated for the hacking of the New York Times bestseller list. So you've heard her before.
Yes.
On the show.
She's
really
wonderful.
Good. Okay, Rebecca, ladies' choice for our next story. Ah. Here.
Well, you know, I just want to toss out a recommendation for a link that we'll put in the show notes, but just something that I read this week that brought the kind of nuance that I want to see to the conversation about what are we doing when we take, you know, racist books out of our libraries or off of our shelves. And so it's a piece in the Washington Post by Valerie Strauss called Breaking Up with Your Favorite Racist Childhood Classics. And it provides, you know, it provides, I think, a lot of context. She is also talking in detail here with Philip Nell, who wrote some of the big pieces about Dr. Seuss being racist, about how to think about what you're doing when you can both love this book and also recognize that in new framework and under today's way of thinking about a thing, it is not acceptable or it's become problematic. And she introduced a phrase that I hadn't heard before called reflective nostalgia, which I thought was just a nice way to explore it, and talks about the value in letting go of these things, you know, not trying to separate the art from the artist, but looking at the whole complicated picture as this thing is no longer like in line with my values because my values have changed. I have grown and our culture has grown, and that having to have this conversation or this internal struggle is a sign of progress and a good thing. But just gives it some really beautiful, Philip Nell especially gives it some really beautiful, I think, and helpful language that removes, like, if you've been dealing with anybody in your life who's talking about cancel culture and why are they canceling Dr. Seuss or whoever, I think there is some, not softer, but maybe some less incendiary language in this that might lead to actually having productive conversations about what we're trying to do here. And I do think that there are folks along the political spectrum who are lit up by the idea of cancel, but that are also potentially open to thinking about, you know, we want to update our priors accordingly. And it's not being presented to them that way, especially if they're really just covered in right-wing media. So I found it to be really grounding and helpful. And I think that there's a lot of good thinking going on there. So we'll leave the link in the show notes for you to check out.
Let's do one more sponsor and then kind of a couple fun things here at the end.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have 7 great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number 6. So if he is to have 7 great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away With Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
You know, this piece makes the point that I hadn't thought about in a while, that the era of the literary feud had seemed to be dormant. Weirdly, because of social media, you'd think there'd be a lot more opportunity for distance face slapping as these things go. Now people get in fights and stuff, but we don't have the kind of feuds historically. And there at the top of this, this is a piece about Lionel Shriver and Cynthia Ozick. And just for the record, I'm team Ozick till I die. I love Cynthia Ozick.
And
Lionel Shriver, again, I'd be on most sides against Lionel Shriver. That's Cynthia's Ozick. It makes it super easy for me.
Yeah.
Piece by Alison Flood in The Guardian. The history of the literary feud is so colorful and also feels not super fraught. Like it feels like mannered feuds. Like this is, but I think there's pieces of this that are kind of gross and also not unseemly for everyone involved. But right now, all I want in the world is like an Aaron Sorkin play about the feud between Tom Wolfe, John Updike, Norman Mailer, and John Irving. Can I get that?
Which I did not know about until yesterday, but you know I clicked on that link with a
Please read that. And then, you know, Norman Mailer, and as you might, Norman Mailer basically feuded with The World show title. Richard Ford shot a book by Alison Hoffman and mailed it to her, which frankly is borderline, like maybe the FBI should open a file on that. But
when he spat, Richard Ford spat at Colson Whitehead.
That has a racial valence that is not funny. That over the line to spit writ large, but like that it's old Colson Whitehead and that is not okay.
It's really extra. Yeah.
But the germ of the idea, or the germ that give Flood the reason to sort of talk about some of these things with Cynthia Ozick, Lionel Shriver wrote a bad review of her. How many people read Lionel Shriver's review of Cynthia Ozick? Like it's like three subscribers to the New York Review of Books. Like this, now we're talking about stuff we don't care about and we just were berating people for not beloved. So we're like, there's sort of an order of magnitude thing going on here. But having said that, then Cynthia Ozick responded by writing doggerel poem response, which is kind of great and kind of the winking, not taking it too seriously, but also not taking it laying down response that I'm looking for here, I have to say.
I mean, it's great. Oh, look, the writer's so old. Reviewer of year 64. In the quiet of her nook, the writer is shook and roars in her wrath, anathema.
For the blow Shriver's given, may she never be shriven. Pretty funny. Yeah.
I think it is the exact right way to respond to Lionel Shriver in a like, I see you, and I refuse to take this seriously.
Also, the Maurice Sendak, Salman Rushdie beef. Who would have guessed? It's like Mad Libs.
That is like Mad Libs, that the two of them would have any kind of interaction, much less a beef.
And I cannot say the words that Maurice Sendak said about Salman Rushdie, nor can I say what Maurice Sendak said he did to Rushdie.
I mean, real guts to describe anyone, but especially Salman Rushdie this way.
Who's got his own baggage, let's say, at this point, I think we know, but also a super important writer in his own way. So a little lighter note. And then the lightest of all notes that makes me happy.
Yes.
Maybe the only thing with a higher Q rating among book nerds of a certain ilk than the library is the Pizza Hut Book It program. Mm-hmm. Summer reading program for its second year back from the dead. We talked about this last year. They brought it back. Kids, it really flourished in the 80s and 90s, as you might say. Virtual camp, kids ages 4 to 12, June through August. You can roll your kids, reading progress, get some pizza. I must have signed up for this because I got a promo email with a link where you buy the vintage original Book It sticker shirt. And I almost did it. I think I might buy one of these.
I was just looking at the logo for this year. It has a like Southwestern feel with a cactus on it. And I was literally about to say, how do I get this t-shirt?
Scroll down, but scroll down. Do you see the original McChicken sandwich version of it there?
Oh, Jeff, I think
it's $10. I don't know. Anyway, so again, one of the great reading programs, I think, especially last summer, I think it was an auspicious time, but also unfortunately got lost in, you know, pandemic world ending stuff. But maybe this summer is a time where more people come back to it and do a reading program too. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of one of the people, a kid that they just lost money on. They want people to read, but like I was going to read the 49 books or whatever and get my pizza anyway. Kid's favorite pizza is Pizza Hut. We have wonderful pizza here in Portland. Michelle and I often will get, you know, no free ads, but Pizza Shoals here, Pizza Jerk. There's a lot of, you know, especially in pandemic time, you call in, you go pick it up. You don't have to wait in line for 2 hours like you used to. Friday nights, we got in this habit of getting Pizza Shoals, which is just wonderful, wonderful pizza. And I asked them, okay, it's pizza night. What do you guys want? Every time it's Pizza Hut. And that's my fault because it's super nostalgic for me. And so we get it just enough and the kids like it. So we're definitely going to be doing Book It for the summer reading program. I think that's our show, Rebecca.
I love that. I mean, I have to go buy a t-shirt now, so we have to hang up.
It's just free ads for them, right? I'm paying them to wear an advertisement for Book It. But it doesn't say Pizza Hut. It says Book It.
It doesn't. It just says Book It. I feel like, neither of us is a person who has a whole lot of literary t-shirts.
No, not strong. And not strong.
Yeah, we're not. I'm not rolling through the world wanting strangers to be like, oh, you like books? I like books. Like, I got to think about books for 40 hours a week, and that's enough.
I do get compliments on my out-of-print shirt that looks like a stamped library card. I do have one of those, people often stop me to say, oh, I like that.
But I am willing to have nostalgia conversations with strangers about Book It.
You know what I didn't realize about the Book It logo is that reading and rainbows were having a real moment in the 80s. Because this is a rainbow thing here. Mm-hmm. Is LeVar Burton... Oh, wait. Was that public radio station going to sue him for having a rainbow on here?
I don't know.
Can we do one more 5 minute sort of a segment? Because this was back a couple of weeks ago and we skipped over because we didn't have time. LeVar Burton's book club. Mm-hmm. But also Roxane Gay and Jesmyn Ward's book club and Steph...
Yes.
The monetization of the celebrity book club is here, Rebecca Shinsky. I'm declaring it here. Now, Literati is a platform for book clubs that they run, and they got a bunch of VC money. They have a bunch of cash. They spend a bunch of advertising. I see whenever I infrequently log on to Instagram and Facebook, they must know that I'm a book nerd person by following Random House or whatever. And I get incessant ads for them. But Jesmyn Ward and Roxane Gay are doing book clubs through Literati. And I think LeVar Burton's is too, for kids books. Interesting. Do we think this is going, what is the business model? Like, how does this work? Are there birdies out here that can tell me? What do you have to give Steph Curry, who makes $40 million? I guess I understand Roxane Gay and Jesmyn Ward. They're working writers. We've talked about Midlist. $1,000 a month might make a difference to them. I'm just guessing, right? Like $1,000, $2,000 a month. That could help them put their lives together in a particular way. I don't know. Steph Curry, does he do this just because he wants to? What is literary? Do they give him money? Like, why is he doing it? I'm super interested in this. Do you have any thoughts, theories, or feelings about how this must be working?
I'm assuming that anybody, especially at Steph Curry's level, is doing this because they like books and they're getting paid.
Right. And what's the experience like? I signed up for Steph Curry's Click. I get the book. I pay the thing. And then I listened to a Zoom live thing with Steph Curry talking. Like, what is it?
I don't know. I'm curious. Yeah. Or is it just that you got the curation? It's that just that appeal of the curation of reading the thing that Steph Curry or Roxane Gay recommend.
Yeah. And I wonder too, one thing about like the celebrity Oprah Reese, sort of our incredulity that Reese doesn't have an imprint. You mentioned, and I think it was a really good point, that some of the luster goes away if you know the person is taking with both hands, right? They're recommending and they're getting 40% of the cover price or something like that.
Right.
Does that affect all people's willingness to do this? I mean, Literati and their investors seem to think there's a business here. That doesn't mean that there is, but like people don't Do they equate Steph Curry's book club with some of my dollars are going to Steph Curry? I don't know. I wonder how they think about
that. Or, like, I would assume that if Roxane Gay wanted an imprint, she could have had one yesterday, you know, that...
Do imprints matter? See, this is a great question.
Well, I mean, I think they don't. I think that's why. That's why, you, like, readers don't pay attention to imprints. And publishing houses have not done a good job marketing individual imprints unless that imprint is Penguin Classics in a way that is compelling for average readers. And, like, sometimes when we talk about this, people are like, oh, but what about HarperCollins paperbacks? Right. It's like, yeah, for people who listen to this show, 85% of whom have read To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, like that's a different land. But I think most readers just don't know what an imprint is. If they did know, they don't care. And even a celebrity's name on the spine of the book doesn't matter in the same way that the celebrity person curating the thing seems to be powerful. And maybe it is just that. It's the power of I am recommending this to you seems more genuine on the recipient's end than I am trying to sell this to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'd be curious to know. I've looked for like a long profile piece that has any metrics or benchmarks or anything in there, but how many people are signing up for? I mean, Jesmyn Ward is kind of exactly the most interesting case to me because she's not as online as Roxane Gay, right? She has won major awards. I mean, if we're drafting a list of like 10 writers that we write our names on slips of paper, we bury it in a jar and we dig it up in 100 years and say, who do people remember? Right. I mean, Jesmyn Ward is someone we at least consider putting in there that's alive right now, right? So it's kind of an edge case to me in that Literati, I'd love to know, is experimental? What's their contract like? Do they have a guaranteed minimum? So on and so forth. Is it like Substack where like for some people there's not a minimum, but some people they're recruiting? I think the whole thing is super interesting. Speaking of super interesting things, the other 5-minute thing that I promised was only one thing is last week we talked about NFTs in books and maybe there's some, you know, Little Birdie. I was talking, I had a conversation with someone who asked me directly about NFTs and publishing and what I thought in the publishing industry. And I basically told them the spiel and what I thought. And I said, you know, honestly, it could be interesting. I think we got some feedback that people like NFTs are bad because of all the carbon it takes. I think that's exactly right. I think these proof of work style, which requires all these computing power, carbon emission, people doing computers, whatever, that's not going to work. But there's some proof of authority stuff. There's a proof of ownership stuff that's also blockchain related. Blockchain is a particular way of thinking about it, but NFTs, basically non-fungible tokens, scarce digital goods, however you want to think it, I think there's something there. My point was, and this is something going back to what you and I have said, is I don't know why there aren't limited editions of books. They're signed editions. Mm-hmm. Why isn't there one of 200 that has an alternate dust jacket that you just print at Kinko's at Random House for the new Toni Morrison Library of America thing, one of 500? Yeah. I would pay $75 for that. Why aren't we doing this?
It's apparently all you need since no one's reading Beloved.
That's fair. Well, and that also connects to the other conversation we're having about how people don't think ebooks are cool. Why do people who care about books going to think NFTs are cool? You know what we have for NFTs for books? They're called signed first collector's editions. We have rare books already. I just don't know how NFTs get us anything we don't already have because we have collectible books. Entire industries.
Yeah, and you know, the Powell's Indispensable is the closest thing that I've heard of to limited, like a collector's edition. And those are usually just special slip cases for hardcovers, which, I mean, if that's your jam, okay, cool. But like this is one of 500 in hardcover with a different design than the regular ones are going to be of the new Toni Morrison, I would absolutely pay a premium for. And maybe the production costs are too high or...
Well, Subterranean Press does this with some science fiction fantasy stuff. That's like a $40, like really beautiful hardcover. Right. And sometimes it comes out in another edition. It doesn't times out. And they're really capitalizing on the people. Not a lot of people are going to buy this, but the people who are going to pay more than $27.99.
And you know, like, honestly, this is the kind of thing that they could even do for somebody like Dan Brown, like where most of the folks who are going to buy like these huge popular authors, but most people are going to buy those books like in the long tail. You and I might be the only people historically who were like, it's new Dan Brown day. At our little local Barnes & Noble buying the new books. We can talk about it on the podcast on day one. But like that's even the kind of, like that is a kind of collector's edition that I think would be fun to have. It would have a different kind of meaning than having had a fancy Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. But that is something that I wonder why publishers don't do it more. And maybe the distribution of that is challenging.
Who gets it?
Because
who gets it?
Is it exclusive to Amazon? Do you divide them up between Amazon and other retailers in the same percentage, like the same proportions that they get the regular copies? And then if that's the case, how do you market them? You're boned if you're trying to sell them directly from the Penguin Random House website, because nobody's shopping
there. That's what I would do, actually, because that would be a reason for someone to buy from you. I would think of it that way.
But how are those readers going to find out that thing exists in the first place?
We happen to know that Penguin Random House has 10 million email addresses. You don't, if you have 500 of the new Colson Whitehead, say there's a collector's edition, limited edition, signed limited edition, like an Ansel Adams poster, mm-hmm. like I talked about before, that's numbered and stamped and, you know, pixie dust on it, whatever that pixie dust is. They can find 500 people to buy that.
That's true.
Now, the other question is it worth it to them? 500 books for the world's largest trade publisher? That's why I'm like, NFTs, what are you selling that's going to make a difference to your bottom line, that you shouldn't just invest in selling it to as many people as you can? I mean, I don't know. And how do you split royalties with the authors? Like, there's a whole bunch of interesting questions there. I think the other way you could go about doing it is what we're seeing now happen in the digital book event space is that, you know, our friend Josh, who did Jada or Nigella, or who had he had the digital?
Oh, no, they had Erin French. For her new memoir, and she was in conversation with Ina Garten.
Right. I'm sorry, am I speaking? Is this not for public? But they got to host that thing, and they did the pre-sales of the book as part of the ticketing, right?
Yes.
And that went well.
Yeah, and it was a really...
And that went well.
Yeah, it was a very popular event.
I think you could do something like this. Give it that... You could do your We Support Independent Bookstores thing by saying, you know what? All of Colson Whitehead's limited editions are going to be sold through this bookstore. If you want it, go there mm-hmm. and buy it from them. And you can spread the wealth. You've got enough books. They can move around bookstores. You can have people sign up. You know, you can have... You know, if Loyalty Bookstore, our friend, you know, former book writer Hannah has the Whitehead, and then someone in Indiana has something else, someone in Oakland has something else, you could spread the wealth around, and you just need those super fans to know they're on social media, whatever. I think you could do it. The question is, does it make one lick crap of difference to your bottom line? And my answer is probably no, and I feel the same way about NFTs, because if the thing there is scarcity, you can't do that many, and you're a multi-billion dollar corporation. Like, the people getting NFTs are like independent artists where like 25 grand or 15 million is like, I don't even know, digital artists, it's completely out of my game, but they're not trying to affect the quarterly results for Bertelsmann like Penguin or Random House is. So
right.
I don't really know. I think there's opportunity there, but it's so small that, like, you know, it's like they say, it's not worth it for Bezos to bend over and pick up a $20 bill. For you and I, it is. But for Bezos, it's like, I got to make my way to the helicopter that's cost $5,000 an hour. all right. So two tangents, follow-up tangents at the end.
Well, I have then a belated hero
of
the week that triggered me to think about. So a couple weeks ago when it was Independent Bookstore Day, I was scrolling through my Instagram and I saw that Hanif Abdurraqib, who lives in Columbus, Ohio, had posted that he had bought out the stock or paid for the stock of his books at a handful of local bookstores. So if you lived in Columbus and you wanted to read one of
his
books, you could go to any of those bookstores and pick up one of his books. His new collection of essays called A Little Devil in America is one of them. It's excellent. So you could have gone in there and picked that up. And he was like, and if you're able to, please support the bookstore by buying a different book while you're in there. And I thought that was like, if you're a writer who has the funds to do it and access to local indies to do it, that was such a cool and smart way to support the indie bookstores and, you know, get your book into the hands of people and also get some people out into independent bookstores. That was really creative. And I meant to mention it a couple weeks back. So read his book, people.
Sounds
please.
Good. All right, Rebecca, that's our show. You can email us podcast@bookriot.com. You can go to bookriot.com/listen to find the links to the show notes for this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast. You can also continue to vote for either my basket or Rebecca's basket.
you say so hesitatingly.
No, that's just
my basket or did somebody else
lag there?
Somebody else
you
make
can
a
vote
basket
for Teresa's
books?
Basket if you'd like on there. And then I'm going to keep that open for another, at least another week. Hey, for those of you who don't know, most of the downloads for most podcasts happen within the first 2 weeks. So I'll leave it open for 2 weeks, and that'll give us a general sense. Unless I'm down by one, then I'll keep it open for.
Say, are you going to strategically close it?
No, I'm closing it a week from today. Thursday, May 27th is when I'm going to close it, and then we will reveal there. And then, so yeah, we've got Field of Dreams, Crying in H Mart, and then sometime in June, I'm not looking at the calendar right now, we will be doing our favorite new releases of 2021. I've got three of my. Have we decided how many we're picking? We're going to do five each? What do we need to do?
Five-ish? I need to go back and look at my list.
I think I've got three locks already. Three locks. And with some more reading to do, a few more I want to get under my belt. Anyway, Rebecca, thank you so much as always. Talk to you later.
Yep, have a good one.